Washington, the nation's capital. The Voice of America presents Issues in the News. The nation's top Washington correspondents offer their perspectives on the week's major stories. Your moderator is Martin Schramm of the Scripps Howard News Service. Issues in the News begins now.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Martin Schramm, a columnist with the Scripps Howard News Service, and joining me on the show this week are Richard Wolff, political analyst for MSNBC, and Tom DeFrank, Washington Bureau Chief of the New York Daily News. And here are the issues. This is the weekend that U.S. President Obama believes will define his presidency. That's at least what Mr. Obama has been reportedly telling wavering fellow Democrats as he postponed his trip to Indonesia for a second time to try to win support for a Sunday congressional vote on his landmark health reform. In other news, Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu has been working to unmake the crisis his government caused when it announced plans during the visit of U.S. Vice President Biden to build 1,600 apartments in disputed land in East Jerusalem. Biden condemned the announcement, a word carefully chosen after conferring with President Obama. Now Netanyahu has told the United States of what it calls new confidence-building measures, a prelude to U.S. efforts to restart peace talks involving Israel and the Palestinians. In Moscow, U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton met with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov on final details for a new round of reductions in nuclear arms stockpiles. And in Washington, CIA Director Leon Panetta said the United States now has severely crippled al-Qaeda due to its drone activities in Pakistan. Tom, we've got so much to talk about, and we ought to start where we left off last week when President Obama postponed his visit to Indonesia for just 2 days in order to make sure that he had convinced enough Democrats to vote for health care. And the moment he said that, we thought, of course, 2 days never works in Washington. He can't leave Sunday. It's still not going to work. And sure enough, he had to come back and postpone it a second time. What's going on? Will we see health care reform?
Well, I think that we will see health care reform. I don't believe that Obama would have postponed his trip until June, postponing it a second time within 10 days, if he didn't think he had the votes. I believe that the White House privately has enough commitments in its back pocket to win this vote. But I think I agree with you, Marty, that this is really an historic vote, not only in terms of health care, but in terms of the future of the Obama presidency. You know, it was George Bernard Shaw who once said the problem with newspapers is that they cannot distinguish between a bicycle accident and the end of civilization, meaning that the media is often too apocalyptic. But I think in this case, the stakes for Obama really are somewhat apocalyptic if he loses.
And he seems to think that, too. That's what he's been reportedly telling wavering Democratic members of Congress, such as Dennis Kucinich of Ohio, a liberal who he finally got to vote with him. And Kucinich said that that the fate of the Obama presidency is at stake. It sounds like a journalist.
And some of Obama's aides have been saying that in starker terms than the president has been saying it. They say it's the end of his presidency. He won't be able to get anything done. But they also say to Democrats, it'll be worse for you because he's still more popular than you in Congress. And if he's brought down, you're going to be in even more trouble in November. It's a curious dance here. But I think at the end, enough wavering Democrats will have concluded that getting something is better than nothing. In that respect, Obama is like Ronald Reagan. Reagan used to say, I'd rather get half of what I want than jump off the cliff with the flag flying and get nothing. And so I think Obama has taken the same pragmatic approach, and unless there's a dramatic reversal at the very end, it looks like enough Democrats agree with him to get this health bill passed.
That's a good point, and I'm going to come back to it in a minute, Tom. But Richard, first let's talk a bit. You're writing another book on Barack Obama's presidency, and he is reportedly saying that this is the vote that will define his presidency. Aides say it in even more stark terms. What's the truth? How important is it? And is there life after health care?
Well, it is very important, and that's why they're expending so much energy, time, and political capital on it. The underlying legislation is far-reaching. It is sweeping. It may not be everything everyone hoped for, but it does have an impact on this huge and growing part of the American economy, as well as being part of the democratic dream for so many generations.
And it is one-sixth of the U.S. economy. That's a great point you bring up.
The other thing is that this has an impact for many years to come. A lot of it doesn't kick in for several years. Some of it does. And so it has a sort of transformational effect that Obama aspires to having. I think a lot of the rhetoric, as Tom suggested, is really overblown. But the truth is, presidents are only as good as their last game. So if they get defeated on anything substantial, then they immediately are hobbled. And I recall talking to presidential historians about LBJ losing a minor vote on DC rights, and it was just a minor thing. But once you break the aura of the presidency and Congress reasserts itself, then the way the system is designed, the balance of power shifts. That's what's supposed to happen. So I don't think Obama's presidency will be over if he loses. It will be seriously hobbled, and he will be limping for many years before he finds other ways to behave, just like Clinton did. Clinton didn't achieve huge things, but he achieved a lot of small things as he struggled to work and beat a Republican Congress. So it's not that unusual, but the expectations were incredibly high for him going into this. The truth is that I think the way the media operates now, the way we all operate on sort of Twitter time, means that he gets a lot less reward for getting this done than punishment for failing. So if he gets this done, he will already have more points on the board than really any of his Democratic predecessors since LBJ. I don't think he'll be treated like that.
I think so. I remember that vote, actually, on D.C. Rights, and LBJ lifted the little pinky of one hand to try to twist arms, which is to say he did next to nothing at all. Mm-hmm. This would be, to my way of looking at it, more like if LBJ had lost on Medicare,
right,
or Civil Rights Act or something,
right,
of that.
But my point,
or the Great Society.
My point is that presidents can lose authority even on small things.
Oh, yes.
So if you lose at all as president, then you are weakened.
Right. Tom, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say I agree with Richard, but it would be worse, I think, for Obama if he lost, because if he loses, it will be because he was not able to convince enough members of his own party.
Right.
And for a president, the leader of his party, to be abandoned by his own makes the damage even worse.
I want to go back to the point you made also about Ronald Reagan. Half a loaf is better than none, and that sort of thing, and that is what he did in many ways. Contrast that with what's going on now in the Senate and the House of Representatives among the Republicans. The Republicans are in just say no mode, and when they say no, they mean unanimously no. Not one Republican should vote for the Obama health care program, even if they agree with half a loaf of it.
Republican leaders have concluded, rightly or wrongly, that it makes more sense for them to be in lockstep opposition, to be totally partisan in their approach. The White House believes that if Obama wins the health bill, there will be a rebound of sorts, and the economy will look better 6 months from now, and the Republicans will look like total obstructionists, and they will pay a price in the November midterm elections. I do think the Republicans are going to gain seats. The out-of-power party almost always does in midterm elections.
Well, let's get to the point of it. You're really saying that you believe that the Republicans would rather take back the House and maybe even the Senate than do what they really think should be done on health care?
Well, I don't think there's any question about that. I think the Republicans are doing what they're doing because they believe it works to their political advantage. And it's certainly clear for about the last 6 to 9 months, it has worked. Obama's numbers have plummeted. But the bottom line is that may be a penny-wise and pound-foolish strategy by the Republicans.
Richard, the Republicans have made Nancy Pelosi's name, she's the Speaker of the House of Representatives, a liberal Democrat, made it into some sort of a pejorative if they can wrap any Democratic centrist who is struggling to be reelected in a district that went for John McCain, not Obama, last time. They tie that voter with that representative with Nancy Pelosi's name, and his chances for winning go down.
Yeah, well, they've tried that for many years, and I suspect it only really resonates with their own base, and that if you did what Jay Leno, late-night comedian, does and walked down the street with a picture of Nancy Pelosi and showed it to most people, they wouldn't have a clue who she was. I think you have to recognize that most people in America don't engage with these kinds of elections until Labor Day, until September, which is actually a long time away in politics. And there are so many occasions when opposition parties count their chickens before they hatch. They look at the polls several months ahead of Election Day and say, and start cheering and hooting and thinking that they're going to sweep into power. And then you know what happens? The polls move. And politics changes. And the other side of this debate on healthcare, with an economy that everyone pretty much agrees is improving, let's wait and see. Let's just wait until we get to the summer, before we get to the fall, before anyone starts saying, hey, we know how to win in November, because wrapping things around Pelosi, thinking it's about healthcare, I just think it's incredibly premature.
Richard, I'm shocked. You're talking about the audacity of rationality.
I'm wary of forecasts in this town. After staying here for several years, I think I figured something out, which is that these things can come back and bite you. And there are too many Republicans who think that for sure they're going to take back the Senate and the House. You know, the one big lesson out of 2006, when Republicans lost control of Congress, and 1994, when Democrats did the same, was that people were complacent. People did not see it coming. Well, if there's any Democrat who doesn't see the threat to them now, they really deserve to lose. And I just don't think those people exist anymore.
I agree with everything you said.
I think that's
exactly right, which means you can change your mind now if you want, but I do agree. Tom, I want to get to what is in the health care reform bill and why is it important? I'll just start out with one basic. The United States stands alone among the industrialized countries of the world in not offering health care to its people. Basically, if people can afford it and if they have insurance, fine. If they don't, then they just go to emergency rooms and they're treated for the most simple things in the most expensive way. And healthcare costs in the United States are soaring above and beyond where they are anywhere else.
Well, I think the fundamental changes in this bill are that it extends coverage to about 32 million more Americans who have no coverage now. It requires most Americans to buy health insurance or face a penalty if they don't.
And gives a subsidy to the poorest who can't afford it.
Right, that's exactly right, making it easier for them to have it. A grab bag of other populist provisions when the bill is fully implemented in 2014, insurers will not be able to deny coverage for people because of pre-existing medical conditions. That's a popular provision. Insurers will not be able to throw you off your insurance if you get sick, things like that. So basically, it is not the grand design that a lot of liberal Democrats hope, but it is probably better than half a loaf if you believe that health care reform is a necessity.
Well, we'll get back to it in just a minute, but first a reminder that you're listening to Issues in the News coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. I'm your moderator, Martin Schramm, at the Scripps Howard News Service, and joining me on the show this week are Tom DeFrank, Washington Bureau Chief of the New York Daily News, and Richard Wolff of MSNBC Television. Richard, as we look ahead, do you think that that President Obama envisioned himself being, when he ran for office, the sort of president he has turned out to be on health care reform? In other words, do you think he has been the bold leader for change in the way Washington works and the way Washington does things, or has this been more business as usual in Washington than Obama thought? And you wrote the book on him running for president. What do you think?
I think there are two ways to look at it in terms of his ambition. One was that there was the classic Democratic agenda, like healthcare, that he definitely wanted to move ahead with in ways that his immediate Democratic predecessor, Bill Clinton, couldn't achieve. So, yes, he had that kind of ambition to transform politics shift them into a more Democratic-leaning position, just as Reagan had done in the opposite direction in the 80s. That's one piece of it, just on the sort of substance. But yes, another half of his ambition was to change the tone and the politics, the way politics was done in this town. And that has been a singular failure. They were not expecting the kind of permanent campaign that the Republicans ran, which was, frankly, a little bit naive. And that has frustrated his efforts to be a bipartisan leader, which was really his goal. I think that's the big difference. People say, oh, he's just like Bush. Bush wanted to change the tone in Washington, and he said he was a uniter, not a divider. Yes, but his style of operation was never about compromise the way Obama's inherent personal style is about compromise. So it's very hard to unite red and blue America, as Obama talked about in 2004 and throughout his campaign, when his opponents on big stuff really just don't want to play ball at all. And that's been a defining, concerted strategy from the Republicans.
I would say they've basically said things that they knew were demonstrably untrue about what the bill actually says and does in order to try to help their cause, which is the sort of thing that we're used to seeing in Washington. But it's we saw the Obama side doing much the same and having these backroom deals to get a vote here and a vote there.
Politicians distort things all the time. But what's been really impressive about the Republican effort is that they have maintained party discipline on the big legislation, saying not one defector, not a single defector can go to the other side. That's actually really tough to execute, and they've done it because they know if they gave Obama any bipartisan support on anything, it would allow him to look like a new kind of leader. That's what they've denied.
Exactly. Let's move on now and talk about the Middle East, Tom. And we can start by talking about what happened just a week ago with Prime Minister Netanyahu's government announcing construction of new apartments in the disputed lands in East Jerusalem, while Vice President Biden was there in Israel having one of these meetings that was designed to do just one thing and say, we are unshakably standing alongside Israel. And that was important for President Obama, because Israel has had doubts about President Obama. And then they embarrassed him, and next thing you know, Obama said, you got to condemn this, and Biden did, and Hillary Clinton said, here's four new conditions that Israel must meet, and they canceled the plans for former Senator George Mitchell to revive peace talks among Israelis and Palestinians, and that was the prelude. Where are we now?
I think, at least rhetorically, the relationship is at a very low point. I was trying to think of when was the last time there was such a chill between Israeli and U.S. Americans, and to me, it was very reminiscent of the time in the 1980s when Secretary of State James Baker went before Congress and said the Israelis were not being helpful to the peace process, and he said in his testimony, here's the phone number of the White House, and he read out the numbers and said, call us when you're serious for peace.
And he the dispute at that time was about Israel planning to build more settlements.
Right. Settlements have always been a flashpoint with U.S.
exactly.
President.
Here's where things are now. Former Senator Mitchell, having canceled his talks last week, was planning to head to the Middle East again to restart them after all. That's because Prime Minister Netanyahu called Hillary Clinton up and gave her what he said were new confidence-building measures. And maybe they were grasping at the thinnest little straws in order to salvage the peace talks, which are most important, but we've seen that happen before. The game is going on?
The game is going on, because when you're hanging at the edge of a cliff by your fingernails, if you don't have hope, then you might as well drop to the bottom of the cliff. The Israeli-Palestinian conflict is in a desperate situation in terms of a peace process. These proximity talks were the beginning of the beginning, and they may still be just fine. What you have is a dynamic political environment in Israel, inside the Netanyahu government, also between Israel and the United States, as people are testing each other out, and sure, trying to embarrass and snub and push the Obama administration, and also Netanyahu. He has the problem on his right flank. He also has a problem in how he is defined with regard to the other center-right party, Kadima, which was in power just before him. These are not great ways to start a peace process. On the other hand, things can change very quickly because the politics are so fluid.
Why do you think Israel does not seem to sense that its best chances for peace for its own people are to help the regime of Mahmoud Abbas, the Palestinian who's got the fight with Hamas internally, to achieve some measure of success that can be security?
I do think we're at an inflection point in the dynamic between the Israelis and the Palestinians, which is that if this goes on for another 10 years or so, there'll be no impetus for peace at all because the politics have moved to the extremes on both sides. The populations are becoming younger and more intransigent. And the dynamic of the new immigrants in Israel, a more radicalized Palestinian politics, means that if it's not done now, if it's not done in the next 5 years or so, that will be it. And there will be no Palestinian state and there will be no peace for Israel. So when they say the status quo isn't sustainable, I mean, this time it's for real. There is no other opportunity after this.
Well, I think that's probably right. And on that non-optimistic note, let's move to talk about the most recent talks in Moscow. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton went there, met with the Russian Foreign Minister Lavrov, and they were talking about the START treaty, arms reduction treaty, nuclear arms reduction treaty that had expired, revitalizing it, restarting START. And in this case, it would be lowering the nuclear arsenals from more than 2,000 weapons on each side to about 1,500, 1,600, something like that. How important is this, Tom?
Well, I think it's important not only in the basic sense of reducing the number of warheads available to annihilate the world, but also in the sense that this is a confidence-building process between the U.S. and the Russians. Relations were pretty bad, to put it mildly, when President George W. Bush left office. The Russians were very upset about his plan to put U.S. missiles in Europe, especially in countries like Poland that used to be in the Soviet orbit. They were very worried about that. Obama has drastically modified that plan. So I think over the last several months, the relationship has been coming out of a deep, deep hole. And I think if they can finally conclude these START talks, which I think they will, things could be better. There's still distance between the U.S. And Moscow on what to do about Iran, the level and intensity and force of sanctions, but the relationship, I think, is getting a little better.
Let's turn to the Iran part of those talks, not trumpeted as broadly after the talks ended, but the reality is that Russia wants to go ahead with starting the reactor in Iran that is supposed to provide peaceful nuclear power to Iran and have control over the nuclear fuel. You believe it? Is it a non-weapons system that's happening there, or is Russia being hoodwinked one more time by the Ayatollahs?
I think it's quite hard to hoodwink the Russians, to be honest. If they have control over the fuel, that's one thing. But for the Russians, this is a commercial activity, and they don't want to see a nuclear-armed Iran either. The bigger problem for the Americans is that when you've got this kind of complicated coalition together, it's very easy to send the wrong message to Iran. Everyone has to have a united message, and that's incredibly hard with a coalition that is barely hanging together.
Exactly. And in the time we have left, Tom, let's turn to something that I thought was rather bizarre, actually, this past week. It was either great candor or boasting, or could be both. Leon Panetta, director of the CIA and a longtime Washington hand, been in the executive branch and in Congress, went to Congress and said that the CIA has al-Qaeda severely crippled in its ability to handle, to do anything, and the success of the CIA drone attacks on working in conjunction with the Pakistani government to target al-Qaeda leaders and take them out has been working. He didn't talk about the drone attacks publicly, but he said there are things that are being done, and that's what he meant.
Well, reporters and others who track these things have documented the fact that what Panetta was saying is correct. Suddenly, an awful lot of Al-Qaeda, Taliban leaders have either been killed, captured by Pakistani American forces, including U.S. Special Forces operating covertly in Pakistan. They have had some success. Now, the political component of this, of course, is the Obama administration has come under relentless attack from the Republicans who say, led by former Vice President Dick Cheney, who say that Obama is soft on terror. He's not making us safer. And so there is a political element. But I think Panetta has a strong case to make when he says Al-Qaeda hasn't been neutralized, but they're in far more trouble. And Joe Biden said recently, Vice President Biden said that Obama said that Osama does not have the capability to launch a massive 911 scale attack anymore because of American attacks.
Richard, do you find it somewhat ironic that it was the Bush-Cheney administration that turned away resources, pulled them out of Afghanistan in order to fight the war in Iraq, and that allowed the Taliban to gain its foothold, and the CIA was unable to stop Al-Qaeda from being an influential force in some areas during that whole period? Certainly the efforts are going better now than before against the Taliban and Al-Qaeda.
I don't know about it being ironic. I find it puzzling that the Bush administration would talk tough about having Al-Qaeda on the run for so long and yet didn't use the kind of drone attacks at this kind of intensity that the Obama folks are doing, who actually don't indulge in the rhetoric.
And they had to work with the Pakistani government in order to allow it to happen, too.
Right, but yeah. it's just puzzling. I don't understand why President Bush didn't do the same thing, and that still is an unanswered question to me.
Well, maybe you can write another book about that. Well, that's all the time we have. Joining us today were Richard Wolff, political analyst for MSNBC, and Tom DeFrank, Washington Bureau Chief of the New York Daily News. This program was produced by Anya Zalewski. Our engineer was David Boddington. And I'm Martin Schramm, a columnist with the Scripps Howard News Service. Thanks for listening.
From Washington, the nation's capital, the Voice of America has brought you Issues in the News. You can email your questions or comments to our panelists. Send them to voanews@voanews.com. And to keep up with all the latest news, tune in the Voice of America on radio, television, or the World Wide Web. Join us next week at this time for Issues in the News.